All right, we're with the BCL people again. I remember you from last time we talked. Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Matt Ellis. I'm a developer. These days I own collections, globalization, and isolated storage.
Cool.
My name is Emil Danforth. I'm a PM on the team here. So I basically own a few of the I/O and low-level APIs, as well as the API surface area that we expose for Metro-style apps.
Cool.
Hi, I'm Wei Taosu. I'm a dev on the team. I work on mainly Reflection.
Reflection.
And Refamid, LCG, all that good stuff. And something else.
I'm Nicholas Blumhart. I've just come back to the team, currently spending some time on the Managed Accessibility Framework, or MAF.
Cool.
Hi, I'm Alok Shriram, and I'm the new guy and the new MAF PM.
All right.
Hi, I'm Kevin Ransom. I work on MAF. I'm a developer.
Hi, Brian Gruckemeyer, BCL janitor.
Oh, come on.
I'm Greg Pepperin. I'm a dev, and I own System.io and the async experience for the framework.
Hello, I'm Daniel Plaisted, and I've worked on MEF, on portable libraries, and on the .NET framework for Metro-style apps.
Excellent, man.
And I'm a tester, if I didn't say that.
Cool. So I'm going to point at good old Gruckenmeier, because I like putting you on the spot. What's new in BCL? What have you guys been doing?
So we've been doing a number of things to help our developers in many small little ways with some interesting new functionality. So we've done stuff like new zip APIs, read-only collections, some async support. A lot of these things, they may be somewhat small or medium-sized features, but we're actually making the platform much easier for all of our users to target. And so we've gone all over the place, and we've even done usability studies in Visual Studio on some of the things we've done as well. So we think 4.5 is going to be a lot of fun for you guys.
Great.
So please check it out.
Excellent. And so let's jump right into here. I'm going to turn the camera this way to Mr. Collections. Read-only collections, what's the big deal? Why did you decide to make any changes since they weren't read-only? We never had them before.
So Emo probably is a better person to answer the drive behind that.
So,
he did more of the work, and I was focused on other things at the time.
Oh.
So one of the interesting things is to note that, and I think in 2006, we published a blog post explaining why we would not add read-only collections.
Yes.
And one thing to note that our read-write collections that we have basically two modes. Either they're really read-write, or they're read-only. This is basically a flag that tells you, yeah, this is not read-only. So the typical scenario would be like something like the keys and the values on a dictionary object. They're conceptual read-only, so you cannot add to them, but you can add to the dictionary, and then you can basically, you know, use them and, you know, query them and as long as you want. But this whole thing might change under the cover, so they're not guaranteeing any mutable. They're just, you know, read-only. And this is meant as a way to implement object models that, you know, ensure certain consistency between different states like keys and values, for example. So the interesting thing to note is that in the new profile, the Windows for Metro-style apps profile, the WinRT folks added read-only collections. And this means on our side that we have to have certain counterparts to actually have a really good experience with using those APIs. So we decided to actually design these APIs. Mm. So when we did the initial design, we basically only chose to have parity between what's in WinRT and what's on our side. But later on, we discovered that one of the cool features that we added, I think in 2010, was covariance. Mm. So I read-only list, because it's really read-only, we can actually make it covariant. So that means if you're declaring your method as taking an I read-only list of object, you can actually pass it an I read-only list of string, for example. Which with the read-write ones, we cannot do because it wouldn't be type safe in all cases. So they actually enabled some interesting scenarios. So we decided, yes, although our reasoning in 2006 was valid, some of the things change, and all, like, the focus is slightly different. So it's a worthwhile feature.
Absolutely. Excellent. Now, one of the things I know that's huge these days is async.
Yes.
And so I want to talk about the fact that you guys have actually baked async deeper into the BCL, right?
Yes. So we have a few different ways to expose async APIs. We have this event-based model and the begin end action model, and it was all quite hard to understand. You had to have a certain level of expertise to deal well with these APIs. And, you know, in the current world where there are new windows and all sorts of new things need you to do asynchronous programming, mm-hmm. we basically went back and rethought the way how you write this in code. The compiler team added some new keywords, and this allows you to write very clean, very easy to understand code that is executed asynchronously, mm-hmm. but it looks like normal procedural code.
Yep.
And we created also a new, well, this is not from this release, but already in the last release, we created this new way to describe futures with tasks, and now we went across the entire framework and added ways to do everything, all the synchronous operation that we used to have before can be now done using this new model, mm-hmm. where you have tasks that represent all the different asynchronous operations. You can use them with the new compiler keywords, so it's very easy to write this code that does asynchronous stuff, and also very easy to use it, to consume it. You simply prepare certain expressions with the async and the await keywords, and as a result, you know, you write very easy code that actually runs on some other thread. Mm-hmm. And we went through the entire framework and made sure that stuff that makes sense to be asynchronous is actually asynchronous, that we added all sorts of APIs to basically consolidate and move away from this old begin end model.
Sure. So now you guys are using tasks, and you have your base. Some of your base class types are returning tasks, right?
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Yes.
And also, you're using the new async keyword, the async await keyword model down in, because the PCL is implemented in C#, not BB.net. Which BB.net actually supports async too. So I'm sorry.
So there is one sort of interesting thing about. We may have misled a little bit, is that for this release, I don't think we too much have used the async and await keywords within the implementation of our own stuff. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is the compilers, like we had to do a bunch of work concurrently with the compiler folks. So as the compiler folks are trying to add these new keywords and get the code gen working, we're trying to take our APIs and move them into this new world, mm-hmm. which means like, we didn't have a drop of the compiler that we can consume these keywords from until, you know, much further along in the product cycle.
Sure.
So we didn't want to block on, you know, oh, well, we need to get the compiler done so we can start consuming all this great stuff. For some things, we had to end up doing them by hand. And that'll be something we can change in future releases. But it is interesting when you work on the BCL, like at such a low level, it's sometimes hard to consume new C# features as they're coming out, just because, you know, we don't have a compiler that has that stuff that we can build against, mm-hmm. Until much later in the product cycle.
But you do have the task parallel library
that you can then surface tasks up
so that the consumers, they don't really care about your implementation details.
Yeah.
And it's a very good point that Matt ties into. So this is my first release on the BCL team, mm-hmm. and it is really very exciting to work at the bottom of the technology stack, where you work basically in parallel with the compilers are bringing new features online, we're bringing new library support. Some of the stuff that we do, they actually need for mm-hmm. their compiler features to work properly. Some of the stuff that we need is done by them. So it's really exciting to work on this level where, you know, together with other .NET teams, you kind of bring the entire stack.
Sweet.
That's actually one of the awesome things about working on this team. We really are an integration point between the compilers, the people that work on the runtime, to some extent the people working in Visual Studio on the great tooling experience on how to actually go target our libraries.
And the framework.
And the entire .NET framework team, but also even Microsoft Research and some of the more futuristic ideas out there. So, with the combination of some medium-sized features in a number of places, such as the async stuff and the read-only support, we can for collections, we can give you a much better programming experience. Mm. One of our friends, Joe Duffy, was very concerned about trying to make parallel programming very easy for developers. But the problem you run into is with race conditions, and most of those race conditions come down to changeable state, and you don't actually know when something is going to have a side effect on something. So if we can introduce async, that's great. It helps people start running things in parallel. But you also, at the same time, need to limit the amount of changes that can take place in your program on other threads. Mm. The read-only collections are one way to do that. So by taking those two features together, we give you a much better multi-threading experience for programming.
Great. In shared state environments.
Yes.
And,
that's
just the world you guys live in. So, Meth. Okay, there he is.
So,
what's new? What's new in Meth?
Well, there's a whole video, an hour long, of Oleg shouting and me being very quiet. that'll tell you pretty much what I'm about to say, but in quite a bit more detail. We got a lot of feedback with Meth V1 that it was very nearly impossible to diagnose composition failures. So we put in a whole milestone of improving the error messages, adding additional throw logic, and putting in debugger proxies and so on and so forth. So it's now possible to diagnose Meth composition failures without your brain melting. So that was a good thing, and it was a whole milestone, and there were no new features on that milestone. There was just fixing diagnostic problems.
Good.
Meth's one of those things. We get back feedback all of the time from people, and it's always very opinionated. There are two types of people in the world: those who agree with me and those who don't. And for whatever definition of me you have, and one group of people absolutely did not want to declaratively put attributes on their classes. So we took a feature that was coming in into the BCL this time anyway, reflection context. And we built a reflection context that would allow you to programmatically add attributes to Meth classes. And Nick will be telling you about his MVC, cool MVC thing that uses this conventional style of programming model that we enabled in Meth. We also added open generics. Previously we supported closed generics. You could export closed generics, but you couldn't export open generics. Well, now you can export an open generic and import it and specialize it however you like. And we did some additional work to make hierarchical containers possible for you to do. It's still not as easy as we want it to be, but it's easier than it was.
Cool.
So that was Meth.
Nice. Now, you mentioned their reflection context, so let's talk reflection dev. That's you.
Yeah.
So that's actually a pretty big feature that helped the Meth situation and any number of other situations. So what is it?
So reflection context, it's a very interesting concept. And so if you think of reflection, then sometimes people refer to it as a way of doing metaprogramming. And reflection context allows you to control how you do that. So I want to call it meta-metaprogramming, but I don't think that's a better term. So what you can do with it is, so traditionally, you do all your reflection in what we call the runtime context. And so you're dealing with all the runtime objects, types, assemblies, properties, methods. You can only work with the things that's in the metadata that's already in your assembly. You cannot, come up with new things to work with. So what reflecting context gives you is the flexibility to, say, in a certain context, add some manifest to this reflection objects you're operating on. Say you want to add property, not a real one, but something you can deal with. You can operate on at runtime, and you can add custom attributes. So these are all under your control through really simple APIs. So you construct the reflection context, you can add these artifacts, and then other people who use the types and assemblies and methods provided in your context, they will see these faked up properties and attributes just like real ones. And this really opened up a lot of scenarios, the Meth being one of them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool. What are some other scenarios?
So we're also one of the other examples is serialization. Mm. So for example, in data contract serialization, you rely on some of the custom attributes to control your serialization behavior. But if the custom attributes are not present on the types, and you cannot do anything with it until now. You can imagine a data contract serializer that uses some other ways to define the custom attributes on these types, the serialization behavior, and from a different source or from any other means. Mm. And so that would be another example.
Cool.
And there could be more.
Sure. Yeah. Interesting.
Designers, I believe, were another potential scenario.
Yeah, designers.
Mm. Like the IDE kind of thing?
Yeah, the IDE like designers, where you put attributes on something to describe how you design it. Well, that would mean that the attributes would need to be baked into the assembly that you ship to your customers, but it's really just a design time thing. So this, you know, I don't think we're actually doing this, but it's a potential scenario where you could actually support it being separated out.
Mm.
So that's another example.
Great. Now, some of the other things that have gone on for the past few years with you guys and is, in some sense, tightening up the BCL, getting rid of things that don't make sense, removing redundancy. You have a lot of telemetry to understand what things actually are used and what the confusions are between close and dispose, for example. What else have you done? Like, let's go through a little bit of what you've done to clean up the BCL. Maybe that's not the best word, but you said you're the janitor, man.
It is.
So it is. Yes. Okay.
And then, you know, actually, janitor is not a bad job description. I end up doing some of the plumbing that allows us to do all this, all the rest of the work here.
Right on.
So we've actually decided to produce a different set of assemblies for you to compile against. So instead of just giving you, say, MS Corelib system and system core, we now have other assemblies that are a little bit more finely grainedly. They're more fine-grained and more isolated for specific feature areas. This enables us to do a bunch of things that we want to do around framework evolution, but it also gave us the opportunity to remove a bunch of the stuff that doesn't quite belong in the .NET framework anymore. Mm. You know, like all technology areas, things just evolve over time. I'd love to draw a picture of this.
And there's a whiteboard.
Yes. Well, while you're following me to the whiteboard, perhaps Emo can talk about some of the other things we've changed.
Okay.
So our goal for Metro-style apps, which is the new .NET, which is a new platform that you can target to have these awesome tablet-style apps.
Mm-hmm.
And for this environment, we wanted to have a profile that is really tailored for these kind of scenarios. So we basically wanted to have less APIs, for example, no WinForms, no WPF, because this platform has another UI stack.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to basically factor the core libraries in a way that we basically get into this picture that Brian is now drawing, as well as we wanted to make sure that we expose the relevant set of APIs. So we basically had to decide which were our favorite kids, so to speak. So basically, for some of the technologies, we have competing technologies over the time, and we cleaned up a little bit and said, yes, this is the one that we really want to move forward. The other ones, we don't really want to move forward anymore. Mm-hmm. So we excluded the other ones from this new profile. And one way we did it is basically by factoring these things into smaller buckets and say, yes, this one is legacy, this one is the way moving forward.
Cool. Excellent. And right. I know that sort of all also helped come out of the I'm not sure what you call it, min.net. What did you call it? Portable libraries.
.NET Core.
Yes.
So the portable libraries helped you guys to kind of hone and shape, right, in this case?
Absolutely. So.
All right.
One way of looking at this is now we have all of the features that are currently in the product, but they're cut up into smaller chunks here. Each one of these essentially has its own lifetime. Some of these, such as things like object, may be around for forever, and other things, such as a data stack, you may need to replace every 2 years. And a UI stack, well, we're on track to replace those about every 5 years here on this team. So a way of viewing this is, here's a set of features that are currently in the product. Over time, the world changes. We get brand new devices, like everyone suddenly ends up with cell phones with GPS trackers and things like that. So you get new features that show up over time, and you want to add them to the framework. So our job is to find some good way to find the set of features that we could build, choose the right ones, and then add them to this version of the framework, leaving us room to add more features in the future. But at the same time, one of the things that everyone involved with any significant software project for any long time realizes is that you got some stuff over here that shouldn't be here. Or it may have been the right thing when you did this, but suddenly the world changed. Great example. If you look at, say, C++'s file I/O APIs, or even Java's first I/O package, they didn't really make a big distinction between characters and bytes. That's perfectly fine if all you want to do is just be able to sell to the US and Europe. But if you want to be able to handle characters for, say, China or Asia or the Middle East, you need to have a very different view of this. So a technology like that, you want to kill it. And so suddenly you start realizing you need a line of things that you put in your product, but now you need to cut them out. Mm. And then you slowly move this line forward over time as well. And you do this based on a number of complicated things, such as your release cycle, whether you're doing in-place releases or side-by-side releases. Mm. But the factoring that we've done of our assemblies into reference assemblies gives us the opportunity to start actually delivering on a very useful mechanism here for removing things over time.
Absolutely. And the reference assembly is going back to the portable libraries sort of implementation. Mm-hmm. And we have a long one on Channel 9 about that as well.
Yes. So portable library is an awesome way of targeting our platform now.
Cool.
So we should be clear, actually, no APIs were taken out and killed in the making of this product. And .NET Framework 4.5 is going to be exactly compatible with 4.0. The technology that Brian is talking about is, will at compile time, we'll simulate it as if those APIs have been taken out and humanely put down. You won't get to be able to reference them. You won't be able to get to see them. And the programs that you build going forward won't have them and have dependencies on them. At some point, hopefully, we'll be in a world where those APIs can be taken off and put in a field somewhere and left to graze out their days without us having to maintain them and feed them.
That's an interesting thing. I mean, I just did an interview on Channel 9 where the people I were talking to who are partners or ISVs for doing some interesting things, they're still using XP. So what I mean is there's always probably going to be somebody in the world that's going to be using something that you think no one's using. So it's like the question would be is, like, sometimes you have to make hard decisions, right? Why can't you just say, we're chopping this off and that's the way it is?
It is actually,
yes. A lot of the time, though, you get as many benefits as you need from just getting it out of everybody's face in IntelliSense. I think that's half the reason to.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So to add to what Kevin just said, exactly. So this stuff hides things at compile time. So mm-hmm. everything is still available at runtime. And in fact, we did a lot of work in this release on compatibility and to make sure that software that used to run on previous versions on .NET 4 not only continues to run on .NET 4.5, mm-hmm. but continues to do that in the same way. So we have a really, really high compatibility bar, and every time when we think about making even the smallest change in an existing API, we have a very, very high bar to actually thinking what kind of stuff can be affected by it somehow. So I had a experience where, you're playing around with some other programming technologies and you upgrade their background stuff and their version even, by a small version number, and suddenly things stop working quite the way you expected to, and you have to go and review your programming code and possibly fix things up. So we spent a lot of effort that people who use .NET don't have to do this.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you started out, this section by asking about cleaning up, and we want to do the cleanup, but we don't want to break the compatibility. So what we're doing now in this release is basically saying, we have this new platform for Metro-style apps. So that's where we're going to make all the changes. Since we're starting fresh there, that's where we can do it. Mm-hmm. But if you're programming against the full .NET framework, then there's no changes. And as we go forward, then we'll probably allow you to opt into this so that, if you want a cleaner surface area, if you're starting a new project, you can opt into this. and have less stuff to worry about accidentally using something that's old or whatever.
So what about, in some sense, what about the notion of less stuff, period? So what I mean by that is we always talk about this when we have the BCL interviews, which we've done on Channel 9 for many years, and that's modularity. Mm-hmm. That's breaking it up into modules, figuring out all the dependencies. Yep. Are. You guys have done a lot of refactoring. It's like, when I don't want to use everything that you have, that you offer, so just stay away and give me what I need. So that's a hard problem when you have a base class library. I understand that.
Well, we're basically starting the support for that by breaking up into these different reference assemblies that are well-factored and have the well-designed dependencies. That gives us the opportunity in the future to do more stuff like that. And you should watch the Portable Libraries video. It goes into a lot of detail on that.
Yes, it does. I was there, but I hear you. But, of course, you're talking to people watching.
Yes.
So ETW tracing in .NET. Now,
yes.
Windows, there, see, I knew I was going to get you to talk. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, so ETW is a really awesome technology that Windows has produced. It's a very high-performance way of producing events that your app can do. So, for example, if you think of some sort of web store, right, you could have events that are generated, you know, each time a customer goes to your site, each time a customer clicks the checkout button, right? And if your app starts misbehaving in production, you can turn on these events and start to get information you need to diagnose your app, as opposed to just, like, attaching a debugger at random places and seeing, you know, what is the state of the app. So this is really awesome technology. Windows uses it across the board. And they've taken this huge bet on it, you know, with Vista and Windows 7. Like, there's just tons of things that produce ETW events. Unfortunately, people who write .NET apps, the support has sort of lagged behind. So in .NET 3.5, we added some ETW APIs into System Core, and these ETW APIs made sense if you sort of understood ETW as a whole, but for new people who just said, you know, I want to produce events that sort of fit in with the Windows ecosystem, you had to sort of stop and, you know, step out of your world, start reading the MSDN docs targeted at, you know, Windows developers to figure out, okay, well, I need this thing called a manifest. How do I author that? Oh, well, it's in XML, so what does that look like? Okay, now I need to compile it. Well, where do I get the tool to do that? It doesn't come with the .NET SDK. And so you could make a .NET app that would produce these ETW events, but there is a very high cost to do so, and a lot of cognitive complexity. So what we did for 4.5 is we said, well, how can we give an experience that is sort of more familiar to manage developers? And so what we ended up doing is writing some classes where basically if you want to produce ETW events now, you write a new class that it inherits from this thing called Event Source, and basically just start putting static methods on it, public methods for all of the events that you want, like, you know, customer entered site, customer click checkout, and they take objects, you know, like an int, maybe it's a customer ID or a string that says, you know, what was in their cart or whatever. And then when you want to generate ETW events, you just call those methods, and the framework behind the scenes will, you know, talk to Windows, encode your events in the right way, and generate them. So you don't really have to understand how ETW works under the covers, and when you see these events in your code, it's very, very clear, like, you know, mylogger.customerEnteredSite, you know, int 5, because it's the fifth customer. That's his ID if he was logged in or something. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very clear what's going on. The other nice thing is that these APIs are very high performance, so you can keep them in your app and pay very little cost if the events are turned off. So you can actually keep these in production, and then when your app starts to misbehave, turn it on and not say, oh, well, I wish I had deployed, you know, my debug build, but it was retail, so I can't have them. And then we're looking at ways for the framework to actually leverage this stuff too. So if the framework is doing something weird, we can tell customers, hey, start collecting these events. And you could imagine us producing tools that say, you know, here's a way to interpret these, to figure out what the framework's doing. We've had tools in the past, things like the Fusion Log Viewer that, you know, picks up Fusion events. You could imagine us doing more tools like that in the future that help you diagnose tricky parts of the framework where you really want some visibility into what's going on. So we're really excited about that.
Excellent. Yeah, it's a big feature.
Yeah,
it's very useful. Now,
Let's talk a little bit about what you guys call customer love features, or at least that's what PMs will say. I mean, I don't know. Like, what are these? What's going on here? Who wants to talk about that?
Yeah, so customer love features, like, I don't know how old this web page is, but what we launched, I think it's not long ago, Visual Studio User Voice, basically, where people can request features.
Yep.
And we had Connect for quite a while now. Uh-huh. Connect is mainly used for bugs, but also for feature requests sometimes. But the problem with Connect is that it's not really suited for people voting for features. Like, you can basically vote forever. Mm. One cool thing with User Voice is that you are kind of, I don't know, you have like 10 votes or something. So we kind of force you to make a decision, prioritize features. Mm-hmm. Because if you ask people what features they want, they almost want, you know, all the features all the time.
Sure.
But if you actually ask, please prioritize them, like if we would build 9 instead of 8, mm-hmm. like, you know, and then they basically say, oh, yeah, actually 9 is more important than feature 8, for example. And like, we review this, like, whenever we start a release, we review the list of things we find through, now it's User Voice. We have MVPs that collect feedback from the forums, and we basically try to address, like, what is the pain points our customers experience.
Okay.
And we try, every release, we try to build a few of these features and make sure that we basically address the biggest pain points. I mean, one thing to note is that, I mean, whenever there's a release, typically a release has a big theme, right? I mean, there's one major feature or one major area that we invest on. Mm-hmm. And it is sometimes really challenging for us to prioritize, 500 customer love features versus this one big thing, basically. And there's always this balance. And so if you look up User Voice or forums, sometimes people are a little bit dissatisfied with how we deal with this. Mm-hmm. But if you think you get a list with, 10,000 of these features, well, you have to make a selection. And we try our best to basically make sure that we address the majority of the problems, mm-hmm. as opposed to, one developer has a specific scenario and we optimize for this, well, then he's a really happy person, but all the other people in the world are not so happy. So it's kind of the balance you want to strive there.
So, I mean, do you see a lot of stuff in the User Voice, sort of the database, where people are asking for less redundancy in the library, in the VCL? Like, how many ways can I do the same thing or close to the same thing? I mean, it's the value of .NET is the VCL,
yeah.
Period. Everything else is a thin wrapper on top of it. So, at least that's what everybody who doesn't use .NET thinks. I mean, everybody who doesn't use .NET, the one thing they're jealous of, for example, let's say native developers, the number one thing they're jealous of is there's no VCL, which you couldn't really have, but you could have a series of standard libraries that were as robust, for example. Mm-hmm. So people are very jealous of the VCL because it's a big bucket of functionality, but there is some redundancy in it.
Yes.
Now, you guys work, do you see User Voice people voting for remove some of the things and focus on?
I think you see this like indirectly. Like, people asking questions, like, for example, there's technology X. Like, for example, we have like 3 or 4 different serialization technologies. And then there's like...
It's 9, actually.
Okay. See? So, 9 too. So the problem is they basically ask questions like, which one should I use for my use case? And our answer is like always, it depends, right? So basically what we try is like for the new profit from Metro Start Apps, we basically try to say, all right, we make the decision for you. We try our best efforts, ask with partners, ask the people who build the technology, make sure that we expose the ones that are the right ones for you. And ideally, you have no choice. Mm-hmm. There's only one way of doing things, and we make sure that it's the correct one. Like, typically, like, if you think of high-level things, it becomes easier, but the lower you go, like, should we have this method on list? Mm. Whether we shouldn't. Like, this is, like, more, along the lines of what is our strategy and what is exposed. So today, we have already, like, a few different ways to target .NET. There's Silverlight, there's desktop, and now there's Metro Start Apps, and then there's the phone. So, for example, one thing that we did is we looked at the phone data and basically tried to figure out what are the APIs people actually use. Sometimes we say, oh, this is a really important API, but it turns out, like, in the world, there are only 3 phone apps using it, the rest is not using it. Mm-hmm. And this API is not available everywhere, so we want to reconcile, so we remove these APIs, for example. Mm-hmm. But we always try to back up our decisions with, removing stuff with what people actually need. Mm-hmm. So we don't try to, rip off, really good features that everyone's using, but we said, oh, we don't like the feature, that's a bad idea. Mm-hmm.
And again, I think by removing, you mean removing from references and stuff?
Yeah, removing from the new profile, basically, yes.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, there's a lot of value in the VCL itself, but then a lot of the value, obviously, in .NET is in the huge set of third-party code that's written on the VCL, and I think, like, part of the value in us making decisions around, what's the right way means that you know, all the different third-party libraries, for example, that do async work can now integrate nicely because we have one kind of task-based method, and it's very much the same with like lazy evaluation and iEnumerable. You know, by actually paring that down and making a decision, we don't provide a whole lot of functionality there, but we kind of give people the building blocks they need to write code that works together, and so the whole thing gets bigger and nicer.
I think the customer love features are kind of a combination of big architectural decisions where we think really about how should .NET programming evolve over time on the one side, and small but very kind of strongly requested features on the other side. You know, one thing is how do you think about redundancy in the framework, how do you think about patterns of you know, providing different technologies, composition, enumerables, whatever. On the other side, you know, if there are very many people asking, hey, add this class to do, you know, weak references of T or zip archives or stuff like this, which is, you know, a comparably small feature, but a lot of people want it.
Great.
And that is another thing that is where we focus a lot of customer love.
So did you listen? Are there weak references?
Yes, we have added some things. I think Brian can talk to the weak references a lot.
Let me tell you about weak references team. So we shipped with a weak reference type. It's just a pointer that, sometimes the object goes dead and the GC cleans it up. But it's a very, very simple, dumbed-down way of doing a cache. And it meets the needs for its purpose. It's very modest, but it works. However, the one that we shipped used object everywhere. And a lot of our customers were asking us for a weak reference of T, a generic one that would allow them to avoid that cast. It gives them a little bit more type safety, a little bit more confidence that they're using it correctly. And so we put that in.
Cool.
We also found a few, like, horrible races in weak reference, and we fixed all those as well. It's good to get all that stuff done. We also had to change the design pattern we exposed a little bit. We exposed a isAlive property. If people used that and then turned around and said, oh yeah, the object's alive, so let me now try calling the target property, well, the target property might not return an object because suddenly in between that window where it was alive and now it's dead, and now you're asking for the target, it could have gone dead. So there were some things like that where we designed weak reference of T to be a little bit better for you guys to avoid some race conditions. But let me tell you something else that just came up over the past 2 or 3 weeks.
Did somebody get him a cowboy hat?
No. So some of our friends on the UI teams talked to us about performance, and they actually found out that a weak reference was using 5% of the entire managed heap for some of the UI applications that they were doing. Yes, WPF uses weak reference very, very heavily.
Wow.
And, you know, 5%, you might think, it's kind of small, but hey, for just a very, very simple cache, just a pointer essentially, you know, that's kind of excessive.
Yes.
So, we gave them weak reference of T. And they started trying to switch to that, and they suddenly realized, hey, wait, since you guys implemented weak reference of T differently, it's actually 4 bytes smaller. This actually saves us a lot of memory. They actually did the math and said that this works out to about 1% of the entire managed heap for a UI application could be saved simply by changing over to weak reference of T.
Excellent.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, 1%, you know, it's only 1%, but at the same time, Rico has always pointed out that managed application performance is directly proportional to the amount of managed allocations that you do and the heap size. So we can actually give you a perf win in addition to some usability wins by switching over to weak reference of T.
Right.
Then we went and we re-implemented weak reference anyways to work the same way. So.
So everyone will get the benefit of it.
Exactly.
That's good.
And so this is where, you know, by providing some very small but interesting building blocks and improving the ones we've already produced, you know, we can help everyone's applications work a bit better.
That's interesting because the number one thing on User Voice all up is remove WPF from the designer of Visual Studio and replace it with native. Have you seen that?
Yes.
So, but maybe this will help the perceived speed problems people are thinking that's happening because of WPF. But I know that a lot of that was worked out in 2010, so I'm not sure that WPF has anything to do with what people are complaining about. But nevertheless, you never know. Maybe this will help.
Yes.
1% of the problem, anyway.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, our friends like Brian Pepin, they do a great job in the designer space.
Of course they do.
Yeah. They're going to make the right calls for you guys. And we're happy to help them out.
Right on, man. So you haven't said anything at the end. You have to say something. So, what team did you come from?
I was actually a dev in Office 365.
You became a PM?
Yes, and I became a PM.
Right on. On
the
interesting.
Side. But it's actually sort of been getting involved with the MEF project, and there's a bunch of stuff Kevin told you about all the new features, and a small plug, like if you really want to get your hands on the new features, you should go to the Codeplex site, mef.codeplex.com, and go and check it out, and we'd love to hear some feedback from you guys.
Cool. And you're also a PM on the team, or are you a dev?
No, I'm a PM. It's interesting, I've come fairly late into this cycle, so I don't really deserve a whole lot of airtime. But but one of the cool things about going back to looking at MEF specifically after a while away is that I think in V1, like all V1s, it's a really feature-focused kind of thing, and there's a lot of sort of small feature changes that you'll see have been done for the V2 work. But once you actually step back and look at it as a whole, writing code for MEF in V2 feels a whole lot different now, actually, to what it felt in V1. Especially, I think that's come out of more focus on the web scenario. You know, trying to look at more application pattern type stuff. And I think that it's a whole lot smoother. So you should definitely check out the Codeplex site if you have any kind of experience with MEF, because you'll see it's quite a new beast.
Cool.
You should talk about the MVC thing.
Well, I think part of when we're looking at making MEF work better for web apps, currently we're really focusing on MVC because it's geared towards this kind of ASP.NET MVC, if you haven't already come across it. It's like one variant of an application model for ASP.NET, which is a particularly nice proposition. So we're doing some work to make the out-of-the-box MEF ASP.NET experience or ASP.NET MVC experience a whole lot better this time around. It probably involves some NuGet goodness.
Good.
But you can get more details on the team blog for that one. It's quite
great.
Involved.
It sounds very interesting. Yeah, MEF's interesting, for sure. And we had a good conversation about that. Now, before we end, what are some of the big problems you guys are thinking about for the next? I'm not asking you what features are coming. That's not interesting, because they're not going to come anyway, because you're going to change it. But, you know, what are some of the big problem spaces you're looking into?
So I think like this release in particular was kind of the starting point for us to basically think more towards the engineering processes and the factoring of the framework. And one of the things with being the BCL basically means you're at the lowest end of the managed stack, so to speak. So we do lots of things across the framework, which is like, for example, API reviews. We talk to the guys building the applications, talk to them and make sure that they have the right factoring without actually telling them what they want to build, but we try to help them make the right decision with factoring, and I think we will see a lot more in this space moving forward. And like we did a lot of these enablers in this release as part of our support for Metro-style apps, because it was like the first new thing we could build, so we basically use it as a starting point. But moving on with this whole vision of what you can see in the portable library video, where we say, portable library was something like an afterthought, and we basically want to transition this to a you first think about portability. First you think, what are the platforms you want to run on? And then you select the dependencies, accordingly. You don't take dependencies on stuff like, that that are not on the platforms that you want to support, for example.
Yeah.
And basically moving this a little bit more, across the stack, all the other teams, the tooling, there's a whole bunch of things we need to do.
Agreed.
So I think the big things going forward for us are going to be factoring and making ourselves smaller, making our footprint smaller in data centers, making our footprint smaller on installs, and on devices. So, there'll undoubtedly be SKUs, I imagine, that expose the new profile functionality, but that's all you get, not the backward compatible. I imagine that we'll do something like that. It's certainly something that that we're getting excited about figuring out how to do right now.
Cool. I think, like, with every mature product like the .NET framework now is, you know, at the beginning you start off with adding a lot of features and you're trying to enable all sorts of new scenarios, and the product matures, and this is the stage where we are now. You still add some new features, and we always will add features. We always will do customer love and whatever the overall theme of the release is, but more and more we'll be doing framework evolution stuff where we refactor stuff, think about cross-cutting things, and, you know, the things you guys just mentioned.
Yes. One of the problems that we haven't really addressed yet is a safe way to obsolete stuff. We can add the obsolete attribute, but it breaks some portion of our customers because everyone likes treating warnings as errors. In particular, for ASP.NET, they don't quite compile against reference assemblies, so they run into a number of problems here. If we start obsoleting stuff and do in-place releases where they upgrade their websites and suddenly nothing compiles. Mm. So I think there's some tooling there that is relatively easy to go after. I'm also kind of excited about some of the slightly more researchy things that we could be doing here in the space. Mm-hmm. Two things that I really want to do are, first, now that we are in the Visual Studio organization, I'd love to work very closely with the people in VS on IntelliSense sorting. Turns out that we can come up with some statistics on how frequently certain APIs are called and whether you're actually going to use a particular type. We can sort IntelliSense based on that. Mm. Just an idea. We tried a prototype, did some usability testing, and we got kind of mixed results. But I think that we can revisit that in the next release. And then the other thing that I'd really love to see us do is some sort of thread safety annotations as well. Mm. We've come up with some concepts like purity. We don't have any checkers for this. There's kind of a tension there between wanting a completely sound system, but also something that's very usable. And it's very easy to come up with a theoretically sound system that is too odious to actually be used in practice. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I think we can help out with a little bit.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Well, it's always great to come talk to you guys. And well, I guess we'll see you in the next release, whenever that is. And good luck with the things you're working on. And you know, keep on keeping on, man. Cheers.